Yeah, thank you everybody for coming out. I gather this was rather short notice, so I'm glad you could make it. So yes, I'm going to talk to you. This is unfortunately not yet real hardware, but what we hope this looks like. I also want to thank all of the collaborators. We are now up to about 25 institutions across the planet, so work of a lot of people. We do have a web page where you can see more pictures too if you'd like. So what are we doing? Well, we're going to look at the 21-centimeter transition of hydrogen. So just as a reminder, hydrogen, there's a spin-flip transition where the nuclear and electron spins are aligned and anti-aligned, and that radiates at 21 centimeters, 1.4 gigahertz. So all atomic hydrogen in the universe will put out radiation at this frequency. Molecular hydrogen does not, and ionized hydrogen, of course, does not. So you have to make sure, if you're going to look for stuff, that it has atomic hydrogen. But if it does, anything you can see in the universe will have this. This fact, okay, this lifetime is actually, this transition is forbidden, and so the free lifetime of a hydrogen in the excited state is about 10 million years. So, it takes a long time, and you can actually get that the temperature you derive from the ratio of the excited to not excited states, that's called the spin temperature, and that can differ quite dramatically from the kinetic temperature of the gas. And especially if I have time to get to the end, so if Niyesh doesn't ask questions, this will become important for another experiment. So we're going to look at 21-centimeter atomic hydrogen. And this is a very powerful probe, right? Because hydrogen is the most abundant stuff in the universe, and you can see atomic hydrogen anywhere. And there's not a lot of confusion. So if you see a line below 1.4 gigahertz, you're almost certainly safe saying that it's hydrogen, especially if it's bright. So it's also spectroscopic. So radio telescopes intrinsically, this is going to be observed by a radio telescope, intrinsically generally have a very good frequency resolution. And so this is why people are building SKA, they act as all sky spectrographs. So this is something that optical people would love to have. If you see an object, you get its spectrum without having to have a slit, the full field. And because we can observe 21-centimeter hydrogen over a large range of the history of the universe, we can use it as a tool to really understand the growth of structure. We haven't done this yet, but we're all working on this, and what could go wrong? So you can use it as a tool to really look at the growth of structure and evolution of the universe. So one of the things we'd like to apply this to is studying dark energy. So the original publicly accepted dark energy evidence came from looking at the brightness as a function of distance of supernovae. So standard candles. Now, there are people who said, if you have drinks with Dick Bond, he'll say, oh yeah, we knew that there was lambda long before the supernova cosmology stuff came out. And in retrospect, he was absolutely correct. But the supernovas were really important. The standard candles were an important tool for convincing people that indeed this dark energy was real. Now, I don't think I have to remind people here that dark energy is weird and shouldn't exist, but does. And anytime you're 120 orders of magnitude off of your natural value, there's a pretty good chance that the world may be a little bit more complicated than your natural value theory suggests. So we don't know for sure that dark energy doesn't evolve. And this is something we'd like to check. So as I said, one way of doing this is with standard candles, but another way you can do it is with standard rulers. So if I have a population of things whose size I know, I can watch the apparent angular size of that over the course of the universe. And that tells me about the evolution of the scale factor. And so I can work out, and that directly comes from the history of dark energy. So if I can make precision measurements of that, then I can say what dark energy is doing. So all we need now is a population of things whose size we know that fill the universe over all cosmic time, and we're good to go, right? So that'd be nice to have. Turns out the universe has been sort of kind to us. So we've all heard about the CMB in here. Interesting reminder, what's happened is that you start out with a bunch of fluctuations. They all started in phase at the Big Bang, and they grow with they grow with time. So these are acoustic oscillations. You have gravity providing pressure, and then photon pressure, because that's locked to the electrons. So as electrons collapse, that drags the photons with them, and that raises the pressure, and then you get acoustic oscillations that way. And the speed of sound is constant. for all wavelengths. And so if you look at the evolution, the frequency is just set by the wavelength. And if I stop my clock at any point in time, you know, waves of a certain wavelength will be a density maxima, waves of different wavelengths will be a density nulls. And you know, the waves at which, you know, the wavelengths at which that happens depends on when you stop your clock, but it's a very generic feature that when you take a snapshot, you'd expect to see, you know, ripples in the amplitude is a function of wavelength. So of course we've all seen this because that's the microwave background, and this is exactly what the power spectrum is of the CMB. So these are fluctuations that have gone, that are at their first collapse, if they started as over densities. If they started as under densities, they're at their first expansion maxima. And this is the angular size, the amplitude, the RMS, well, the squared amplitude is a function of wavelength. First peak is around the size of a full moon, so you don't actually really need very high resolution to do this. And this is what we do with, you know, what I've spent much of my life doing is looking at this. Of course, we have, you know, increasingly beautiful data. This is from a, you know, Planck plus a sixth of the actual data we've already taken, actually less than that because we've taken another season since I made this slide. And missing from here, unfortunately, is data from the South Pole Telescope, which are also beautiful. So, you know, we understand what's going on at the time of the CMB really well, you know, way better than a percent. So, what's happened at the CMB is that the universe has gone from ionized to neutral, and so you've lost your electrons, and therefore you've lost your photon pressure. And so these ripples now get frozen in, and galaxy positions should remember about this, because the amplitude as a function of wavelength is now changing. Yeah. You want to look at active spectra?
Yeah. Is this, I'm just thinking, it looks like that all those points in EES spectrum are below the curve. Is that the real thing?
I don't think we think that's real.
Okay. You don't think you think that's real? Okay.
I don't know. We never spent, we had bigger things to worry about to get this out, so that requires beers to talk about. Don't ask us about like large angle side lobes. Don't ask us about large angle side lobes.
Okay, I won't.
At least not without a drink in hand.
What's the next couple?
And so galaxy positions should remember this. So if you know, the same ripples that we have measured incredibly well in the CMB, leave ripples in the galaxy power spectrum. So this has been observed first by SDSS and is a very powerful thing to use for cosmology. So these are called baryon acoustic oscillations because this was set because of the baryons oscillating, acoustic waves. And we understand really well, so the size is set by the sound horizon at recombination, which we understand very well. So we know what the starting conditions were, and then these grow, especially if you look at larger scales, these grow under linear theory. So we, you know, given cosmology, given a redshift, we know how big the angular size, the apparent angular size should be. So that's great. So we have a universe full of rulers we can use to go measure the evolution of scale factor. The slight downside is that these are very large. So the DAOs are something like 100 megaparsec. That's the natural scale, about 120, 130 megaparsecs. So large. And if we want to do cosmology, that's a little bit of a challenge because the entire universe within redshift of 0.1 is only about 100 BAO volumes. So if you want to go off and do 1% cosmology, you need to survey really large volumes over a large redshift range just to get the statistics to do something useful. So, you know, your little standard go observe a few square degrees of the sky with an optical telescope just isn't going to get this done. So, these volumes are large, and what that lets opens up another possibility, which is I don't really care about any individual galaxy. There's something like 10 to the 5 L star galaxies in a BAO volume. So trying to measure the individual galaxies really is overkill for this. So what you can do instead is observe this in low resolution. Basically, you know, by observing it in low resolution, I'm basically stacking the signal from all these galaxies. And look at the fluctuations in the mean brightness. So this technique is called intensity mapping. And the first detection of this was made by Tu Ching Chang and collaborators, actually while she was still at CETA, one floor down from me when it came out. And they did this by mapping neutral hydrogen with the Green Bank telescope and comparing that to galaxy distribution. So it was a cross-spectrum measurement, not an autospectrum measurement. Autospectrum much harder, but it was very clear detection, and the neutral hydrogen density was roughly where you'd expect it to be. So that's great, because this means, you know, this technique really should work. There's a signal to look at, it's roughly the expected level, and you know, if we go out and map all the sky, we can say something useful about cosmology. So this science go really sets the design, the basic outline of an instrument. Yeah.
Graph that you showed us? Mm-hmm. Is that, what is the intensity that, what's the solid curve that you have?
This solid curve? I think that's the model. So that's the best fit model for what you'd expect in the cross correlation. I'm not on this paper, so I can't tell you lots of details. But yeah, if you go off and say, let me, under some model for what the neutral hydrogen is doing at that redshift.
And galaxies,
yeah.
As a function of separation.
Well, this is a K. I think that's a K, right?
I think that's integral.
I can't read it anymore. Oh, yeah, I noticed that you're right. They log H inverse megaparsecs. Okay. All right. But you can go off and read the paper. Right, so this sets the design. So if we wanna look at dark energy with intensity mapping, these BAOs are pretty big, so you don't want a really high resolution telescope. You want something that can see from a few degrees to, you know, a few degrees to an arc minute, a few arc minutes. You also wanna do this at moderately high redshift. You know, there's just not enough volume at low redshift to do cosmology. So, you know, but if you had too high redshift, the dark energy hasn't turned on, we think. Depending on what's happening. And so, you know, something like redshift 1 is a pretty good place to do this. And especially if you want to compare to what the optical people are doing and say you want a different volume of space, that pushes you a little bit higher. So, you know, something like 700 megahertz is where you want to go off and observe. Now, even though we're stacking the signals from 100,000 galaxies, it's still faint. If you want to see an individual galaxy, you have to build SKA, which is not cheap. So we still need to build a lot of elements just to get the sensitivity to see even the stack signal. Now, one thing that's been great for us is that some of you in this room may have heard of CHIME, who are doing similar project in the Northern Hemisphere. And we're collaborating with a lot of the CHIME members. And the digital electronics, which are the hardest part of this, are basically similar. So, I don't know if any of you have heard of the Paper Telescope, which is searching for reionization. The name of that comes about because one of the team members said, you know, if I want to build a radio telescope today, I need paper clips attached to a supercomputer, which is not far from the truth. So this has really, really been key to us being able to get going as quickly as we have. And I also want to thank UKZN, university where we're at, and the South African NRF, who are supporting this work. Also, it's important, sorry, let me go back. It's important to misspell your acronyms. If you ever have to name a project, make sure you misspell the acronym, because that way it's much easier to Google. So Hyraxes with a Y are these little fuzzy critters that are most closely related to elephants and manatees. They are not at all rodents. And they're abundant in South Africa. And so the only people we have to share our name with are these folks, who are a thrash metal band. So it's pretty easy to tell which Hyrax with an I you're getting when you Google. I will say, however, that these guys found us on the web and gave us like a like on Facebook. So I've never been liked by a rock band before. So as I said, this sort of sets a design plan. Our current plan is something, you know, order 10 to the 3 6-meter dishes. Turns out they're not quite the right optics we'd like, but you can go to China and buy a 6-meter satellite TV dish for less than $1,000, which is really cheap. For reference, like an SKA dish is more like $1 million. So we can build 1,000 dishes for the price of one SKA dish. for this part. 400 to 800 megahertz covers redshift range 0.8 to 2.5, where there's a dark energy signal and enough volume to say something useful about the universe. The channelizing and corner turning, which if you care about is a big deal, are done on FPGA boards built by Matt Dobbs and his group out of McGill, and correlation on GPUs. I don't know if people obsessively follow GPUs like I do, but the latest NVIDIA announced one has got special matrix-matrix multiply hardware, so you can do 150 teraflops on one card of single precision, which blows my mind. May not be as exciting to you, but that means that using something like that makes this correlation, which is combining all the electric field signals from all the telescopes together, much cheaper. This wouldn't have been feasible to think about several years ago. In fact, when CHIME started, they had to rely that there'd be, I think, two generations of GPU improvement before you could even think about building CHIME. So they had to do a trust fall into the arms of Moore's Law, which is scary these days. But GPUs have been doing very well. So we want to see a lot of sky. The field of view of these guys in our band is something like 5 degrees. But even then, that's enough to be interesting, but you'd like to be able to cover a lot more sky than just one strip at 5 degrees. And so, students are cheap and enthusiastic. And so the plan is that sort of every few months, when we've observed deep enough on a strip, an army of students or army of local people go out and repoint all the dishes by hand. And you can repoint one of these dishes in a few minutes. So rather than build expensive motors and control systems so you know where you're pointed, send out some students, pull a pin, tilt it over, lock it back in place. And as long as you make that repeatable enough, you're actually fine. And so this way, we can build up strips to fill 15,000 square degrees. We'll talk a little bit more about this LRV stuff. But it's also, we can do things other than dark energy, like CHIME, pulsars, and fast radio bursts, and a bunch of other stuff are useful and very naturally suited to HyREX. So just some points of comparison for CHIME. So CHIME uses cylinders, and we use dishes. So one of the big challenges of this game is going to be dealing with the systematic. So the foreground problem is nasty. The Milky Way is about 1,000 times brighter than the signal we're after, so you have to clean that out. And if you don't do that right, you're going to be dead in the water. So a really nice thing is that the systematics between dishes and cylinders will be totally different. So if we both see the same thing, that's encouraging that we've done it right. The dishes actually, so CHIME was uses cylinders because they're cheap. These 6-meter dishes are actually even cheaper. So if we build the full 1,024-element HyREX array, we'll have something like 3 times the collecting area of CHIME. Which is big. One thing that's really nice about CHIME that we can't do is CHIME sees a whole sky every day. So if you want daily follow-up of lots of objects in the sky, cylinders are really awesome for that. Now, we are in the south, so that's great for pulsars because the galactic center is in the south, so if you want to find new pulsars, the south is where you want to be. We are seeing different skies, so if you, you can add the CHIME results and the HyREX results together, and that'll just increase your errors by the obvious factor, and you don't have to worry about the fact that there's overlap. So basically, electronically, everything but the beamformer is different. Everything except the beamformer is the same. Also, I was looking for this picture last night. I discovered that CHIME had their official first light ceremony a few days ago. So congratulations to them. So all the stuff that we want to use does work and has been functioning.
Computational task is correspondingly easier, or does it
which computational task?
Of just making all the beams and
no. Okay, so making the visibilities, no. That's set by number of elements squared. The beams is a different story, and that's probably a little bit too much detail to talk about now. So it turns out that on a regular array, you can beamform with an n to the 3/2 instead of an n squared operation. So beamforming should be cheap for HyREX. CHIME's using FFTs, but you have to do some clever things. And I don't actually know what signal noise hit you take for the clever things you have to do, like with the varying zero padding to get the beams to line up.
Well, they wander a bit.
Okay, so you're just eating the wander? Okay. We can talk more about this if you want to know nitty gritty about beamforming. And you know, we are expecting that this should indeed be a big improvement in cosmology. So if here's Planck versus Planck plus Hyrax, you can see you know parameters come out something like a factor of two better. And if we are at the sensitivity we're expecting to get to, 1,024 elements should give us a dark energy figure of matter of something like 300 over 4 years. I wouldn't go quoting this number too strongly in public because you know it'll depend a lot on you know the final dishes that we end up with. It also depend on how much daytime observing we can do. The sun is unpleasant and variable. So we'll lose you know a couple hours a day, but maybe more. We don't know what that number is going to be yet. But this is the sort of the ballpark range you expect. So one thing that is nice about Hyrax is with the manual tilt, you do have the freedom to tune your sky area. So if it looks instead like you'd rather, you're better off going deeper over a smaller patch of sky, you can just not repoint the dishes. So Chime, whether they like it or not, has to see the whole sky. And this means you can, you know, a factor of a few, these different curves are for the error in the fractional error in the power spectrum, depending on whether you've gone wide or gone deep. So we can do this. This is literally a runtime decision. As we're up and running, we can say, oh, we want to go deeper, or oh, we want to go wider. So that's a nice flexibility that the dishes give you.
Sorry, I didn't understand. What is the choice you have?
So the choice you have is, right, when you. We can observe. We could observe just a single strip, and so we'd have 4,000 square degrees. But now we'd be much deeper, and so we'd win on sensitivity to high k's. Or we could go shallower over a larger sky area.
But this is a decision you make over, I guess, over a month, because you have to keep moving dishes.
So we don't have to keep moving. We could just leave the dishes.
Right. Okay.
So.
But that's the choice.
That's the choice. Do we move the dishes? Do we leave them put? Or do we want to do one pretty deep strip and then a wider, shallow area. So we can decide that, and we can decide that based on the state of parameters when we're observing. So we don't have to make up our mind in advance. And you know, there is, I don't know if I believe this or not, but there are people out there claiming that there is dynamical dark energy for us to go look at. So that I'm not gonna stake my career on this part, but we might see something.
So you're talking about lambda that actually oscillates, changes in time, but what about non-homogeneous?
We haven't calculated that, but there's no reason in principle you couldn't look at it.
I mean, that you could do for experiment?
I think so. I mean, you'd do the spectrum on small patches, and you'd see that there's varying lambda. So. If you want to go off and do that calculation, I would strongly encourage you to do it. I don't know if you're bored, but if you are. So we can do lots of other things too. Remember, we're taking a spectroscopic survey of the sky, neutral hydrogen, and you know, we don't get individual objects, but you do get you do now get a nice redshift catalog, redshift survey. And if you've got a population of things whose redshift distribution you wanna understand, like something you've gotten from, say, LSST that has photometric redshifts, you can go up and cross-correlate and look at the and get the redshift distribution. So this is important for things like weak lensing, where you need to really understand the redshift distribution of your of the things getting lensed. So there's an Alonzo et al. Paper out showing that Hyrax is actually really valuable for lensing, for calibrating the lensing redshifts, and you you can improve your schematic signals a lot. If you like galaxy formation, I'm guessing not that many people here like galaxy formation, but I could be wrong. If you have clumps of cold gas between you and a quasar, you now see the 21 centimeter line in absorption. And we should be really good at this because we will see lots of quasars every day with high signal noise. And we should see lots of galaxies as they're forming at redshift 1 and 2. Whether we want to or not, if you like galactic polarization, we're going to have a fantastic map of it. We will spend most of our effort getting rid of this, but there are people that like this sort of thing. So you know, it's a very large scale, very sensitive spectroscopic survey. So encourage people to think. I mean, you probably already thought some sense of Chime, but keep thinking about things you can do with this sort of data set. Now a little bit of status update. So our first hardware, this was our prototype. Jeff Peterson at Carnegie Mellon, who's a Chime collaborator, came down with a suitcase full of bits and said, I'm going to show you how easy this is to do. So with a couple of students, we went down to the Durban University of Technology, which is just down the road from us, and within 24 hours had the first interferometer ever in the province up and running and getting fringes on a day. Less than, actually, it would have happened the first day if we'd had enough energy to repoint the dishes at the sun. Everything was working, and we saw them second day. So we started, we're building a prototype outside of Johannesburg. We had a delay on our first set of dishes, so it turns out you can just go to the satellite TV company and buy a 3.7 meter dish for $200. So we went off and just bought four of those and put them in. This took also about maybe 2 days to get the dishes all put in. It helps, so at the observatory there, they've got a crane, so there's a guy there that loves to drill holes. So we had our holes drilled in the morning and fiber laid to our little hut. And this again was up working within a couple of days. So one thing I will say, which I'd like to point out, is this hut is our electronics hut there. There's one GPU node and one FPGA board in there. And that digital signal processing is basically equivalent to the pre-upgraded VLA. So for a few thousand dollars, well, several thousand dollars in this one hut. So it's really, you know, you've got a 16 element correlator with 400 megahertz of bandwidth. All getting processed. So it's you know, the stuff that you can do these days, largely thanks to Canadian collaborators, is pretty amazing. So then our Chinese supplier eventually got their acts together, and we built, these are 6 meter dishes. You know, 6 meters doesn't sound all that big when you just say it, but here's the size of a 6 meter, less than $1,000 dish next to human sized objects. And we now have this up and running outside of, at Hartrau, outside of Johannesburg. So, I think we only have five now. We're short a few feeds. We have collaborators bringing out the next batch of feeds at the end of the month. So within 3 weeks, this will be all eight dual polarization dishes up and running. And indeed, it all works. So this is a fringe. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight.
Yeah, so you said you had five.
So five are instrumented.
Okay.
This guy actually, I think this guy, we had, when I took the picture, we hadn't pointed it, but this guy has a feed on now. Or maybe it's that guy. And they're all pointed together, taking data. And then we'll just put the feeds up in the last three when they come down. So this is one visibility from one baseline over a few hours. And this is when you crack out the champagne if you're a radio astronomer. So this ripple right there, that's an interference fringe from an astronomical source passing through the beam. All this other vertical crap and these little horizontal lines are interference, which is why we don't want to build the whole array here, because a lot of what you'd see is just noise. So you can ask Kendrick. Kendrick probably also would need a drink to talk about this in detail. That the hard part of doing radio astronomy often is not the astronomy part; it's just dealing with this crap. So, as I said, we don't want to do this there. We want to do this out in the Karoo, which is the South African desert where the Square Kilometre Array is going to be. And SKA South Africa has identified a site for us. And Jeff Peterson really wanted to go take a trip, so he took one of our feeds out there, a spectrum analyzer, and measured the interference at the site. And that's this year. So this is a bunch of military satellites, but these two red lines mark off the Hyrax band. And so you can see it's just beautifully clean. Right? We're not seeing, there's nothing in here. So why is that? That is because the South African government has been really supportive. And as part of preparation for SKA, they passed a Radio Interference Protection Act, which turned off all of the UHF TV stations in the area. So if you looked at this a year or two ago, this would have been just TV stations, and they turned them all off. So now, especially this band right here, is just beautifully clean. This little notch is residual cell phone crap. But we're really excited because it's much more pleasant to work with this than with all this crap, which is what the similar plot from Hartrau looks like, and probably comparable to what Chime looks like. I don't know. I haven't seen Chime, but we're very excited about this. So another thing that we're going to do with this that is potentially relevant to Perimeter is looking for fast radio bursts. So what are these? I don't know. They were discovered about a decade ago now. So the first one was seen to flash for like a millisecond and never been seen again. And while it flashed, it was amongst the brightest things in the sky. So in fact, this is a discovery plot. This black thing right here, It actually saturated the telescope, so nobody's quite sure how bright this thing is. The A to D, it was like one bit, so it's saturated. And I think HYRAX really will be the premier instrument to look at these. So these are very popular, all the rage. The day before I left, this was the Google News number two science story, which is the Breakthrough Listen project, which is mostly looking for aliens, found a bunch of bursts. There's one FRB that repeats, and they saw a bunch, so everybody got excited that Stephen Hawking's alien project was seeing aliens. It's probably not what happened, but there's a lot of interest. So here are some hard numbers. I don't know if you want me to say anything, but we should see a lot. The important number is that if you assume Euclidean counts, that HYRAX should see something like 500 times the FRB rate that the Parkes telescope sees, which is the currently discovered, all but a handful of the FRBs known. So CHIME and HYRAX really will be game-changing instruments for the study. So why is this hard? Well, this is hard because of dispersion. This plot is the time versus brightness versus frequency. So what's going on here? Well, if I have radio waves going through a plasma, assume in undergraduate physics we all looked at like plasma dispersion relations, and that was like problem number two in my second year physics class. And so if I've got a plasma, I get slowing. That slowing is frequency dependent. In the low density limit, the delay goes like lambda squared nu to the minus two. So the total delay in seconds is 4150 times the dm, the dispersion measure, which is some weird unit, divided by nu squared in megahertz. And so this works out, at typical radio astronomy frequencies dispersion measures that they've been measured at, a second, this was half a second. At CHIME and HYRAX frequencies, this could now be, 10 or 20 or 30 seconds. So it's large compared to a millisecond, but small compared to human lifetime. Even small compared to a beam crossing time, we hope. So what is this weird unit? So pulsar astronomers like this unit, which is the dm is 1 electron per cubic centimeter over a distance of 1 parsec. So if you care about saying, like, what's the dm through the galaxy, which is, say, 100 parsecs thick with 1 electron per cubic centimeter, you'd expect something like 100 for the dispersion measure. If you instead like thinking about physics and are used to thinking about things like optical depth of Thomson scattering, you just take the dm and divide by 500,000 to get the optical depth. So, what should the max dm be for something that we see on the other side of the universe? Well, 0.06 times 500,000. So, if you could see really high redshift ones, you'd expect to see dms up to, 30,000. So we're pretty sure that these things are from outside the Milky Way, or something different from pulsars. So pulsars are weird. I hadn't appreciated just how weird pulsars are until I started working on this. Their period is very regular, but their brightness is all over the map. So to order unity, there's no correlation between the brightness of one pulse from a pulsar and the next. And sometimes these pulses are very bright. So there are classes of pulsars that have been seen flashing once and not really seen again. But FRBs are thought to be different, and this is one of the big arguments why, which is if you look at the electron column density relative to galactic latitude, these guys are looking nothing like the typical galactic pulsars. So there's a lot more electrons between us and them than there are for pulsars. So a natural way of doing that is putting them outside the galaxy, but they'd also could be, if they have a bunch of electrons close by, you also could think, well, maybe these are in the galaxy, but they, it's some population that has that's cocooned in some electrons. So understanding whether or not they're extragalactic is actually pretty important. I think it is still true that there are more models than there are FRBs observed. So all sorts of we put one of our favorite ones out. And for a long time, astronomers didn't even think these were real, because Parkes, which discovered FRBs, also discovered these things called peritons, which look very much like FRBs, but only happen during lunchtime on a weekday. It turns out if you take whatever model microwave oven they had, if you just run it normally, it's fine, but if you open it while it's running, then it puts out a falling burst that looks very much like an FRB. Now, this doesn't fit the nu to the minus two law exactly, and so people were pretty sure this wasn't right, but could there be a second microwave? I mean, you know, it was a concern. And so, you know, took a little convincing. Now, to search for these guys, you need to, you know, you don't know what the dispersion measure is, right? You don't know what the column density between you and the FRB, and so you have to search over all possible dispersion measures. And so I started working on this a little while ago. Kendrick Smith has really taken over this for Chime. There's a fast transform where you can take your data, you resample in frequency so that these new to the minus two trails will be linear, and then you can do a transform. It's actually faster than a Fourier transform. It's really efficient. You can do this on a GPU, but it turns out that sending the data to the GPU is slower than doing the transform on the CPU. It is if you have Kendrick working for you. working on it. Simple models, like the first version I wrote was actually this much code to do this. It's really efficient. It doesn't scale to Hyrax or Chime size problems, but what it'll do is it'll take all of the signal and stack it up over varying slopes. And so if you get the right slope, you see all the signal all of a sudden gets stacked up in a little point. And so to make sure that this worked, you know, if we're going to go off and find all these things, you want to try this out on real data. We did a test run with people, actually the same group that had done that first intensity mapping detection, because they'd saved their data in such a way we could go back and ex post facto search it for FRBs. So a couple years ago, we started doing this just basically to test out the new pipeline that we were going to use for Hyrax on the same algorithms for Chime, whether or not this works. And there was 650 hours of data. I was pretty sure we wouldn't see anything. Weili Pan, the eternal optimist, said, oh yes, there might be something there. But, you know, always good to go out and try. So here's when you do the transform across a known pulsar. This is the raw data from the telescope, nothing obvious there. But when you do this transform, you can see these pulses all pop out. So this now is time, and this vertical axis is dispersion measure. So as you'd expect, the column density isn't changing from pulse to pulse. And so you see that you get a row of spots at the same dispersion measure. So great, this is real working on real data. And so here's a pulsar, so we would have expected this, but what we weren't necessarily expecting was this thing right here, which is what an FRB looks like in real data. So there is the raw data in the usual scale, it's hard to see, but when you stack it up again, it just pops right out. So this came out as, I think, 26 sigma in the pipeline, and when you do a more detailed fit, it's 40 sigma. And it turns out if you tune your color scale just right, you can sort of see it in the raw data, but it's still pretty hard. And if you then stack, you know, if you take the dispersion, remove it, and stack it up, you can see here this little spike is the FRB. So it's hugely significant. So one of the things that was kind of fun about this is I hadn't appreciated how much information you can glean from just a millisecond flash. So we did some work on that, and it turns out there's an awful lot that you can infer about what's going on, which kind of fun. Most of my life is processing purchasing orders to make sure finance is doing their job. So it was a nice break to do some actual physics. So one of the things you expect to see is that there's electrons in the ISM. And so that's going to affect the propagation of the pulse. Now, the ISM is not perfectly uniform. And so you get a few effects from that. So there's the overall dispersion that's from the overall mean density, but these little, you know, the non-uniformities act sort of as lenses. So there's two modes you can get. So one, if the angular defection is really small, these multipath things actually interfere coherently. That's called scintillation. And so the signature of that is that the brightness as a function of frequency really ripples. And the other thing that you can have is, you know, if you now have even larger multipath scattering, you lose the coherence and you just see the delay. So the scattering leaves you with a tail in intensity. So when we looked at the FRB in detail, we actually saw both of these things. So if you look at the brightness as a function of frequency, you can see over here, this is about a 5 sigma detection, that it's fatter at lower frequencies, which is what you expect for the scattering. And it actually turns out that this width is consistent with the frequency depends you expect for that. But we also saw scintillation. And here's a zoom in. You can see that there's actually, you know, from fairly close space frequencies that the brightness changes an awful lot. So what does this mean? Well, the scintillation is very similar to the scintillation that you see from a nearby pulsar in the galaxy. So the natural interpretation of that is that the scintillation that we see is coming from inside the Milky Way, or at least consistent with coming inside the Milky Way. But we also see scattering. So what does that mean? Now, if something is fat, it's not going to scintillate. So stars twinkle, planets don't. So if the scattering is happening, you know, if this is scintillating inside the Milky Way, that means that the scattering is happening elsewhere, and that scattering isn't broadening the FRB, the angular size of the FRB, enough to break up the scintillation. So there's something happening, there's probably something happening close by to the FRB to make it scatter, but it has to still be a very small angular size for it to have scintillated along the way. Now, some other fun things that we saw was actually, yeah.
So you just found one FRB?
Yep.
It's just an advanced in a repeat.
It did not appear again. We've since done, you know, so that patch was surveyed lots of times. It was not seen again. So so far, one FRB has been seen to repeat. None of the others have been seen to repeat. So this is actually another thing that Chime and Hacks really nailed down now with these large surveys, seeing lots of the sky over and over again. But this one does not seem to repeat. So Faraday rotation. Well, if I have linearly polarized light. So this was the first one with detected linear polarization. It's actually 44% polarized, very highly polarized. Then magnetic field along the line of sight, when the waves propagate through a plasma, also rotates linear polarization in a frequency-dependent way. So this was the first Faraday rotation detected. And it's actually, you know, a very nice detection. So we can measure the rotation measure, which is the integral of n e times b along the line of sight. We can measure this to better than 1%. And it's about 10 times as much as you can get from a Milky Way or intergalactic medium sight line. So there's clearly, I first said must be magnetized plasma near the burst. Technically, if you had some emission mechanism that did a weird thing where it rotated the polarization at emission, you could maybe come with a model like that. I'm not going to set that as a challenge, but basically, there is magnetized plasma near the burst almost certainly that's causing this Faraday rotation.
So if you divide the rotation measure by the special measure, what is the mean magnetic field that
I can't remember. It's in the paper, like a micro Gauss,
okay.
Something like that.
But the micro Gauss is what you get from, ISM, but I guess IGM, I don't know what that is. Okay.
Yeah, but right, okay, so, yes, but you need a lot more plasma. Right, so you can't get that NE from the Milky Way.
Okay, so I guess I don't know what's the number. And microgauss, is that the number?
No, it can still be microgauss, right? But if I say the average field is a microgauss, I can't get that many electrons in the Milky Way without adding an extra population somewhere. Without adding extra population of electrons somewhere. So even if you're happy with the microgauss being a Milky Way number, and again, I need to go check the number. I don't remember exactly what it is. But I know it's in the paper because we had to go through it a few times. You know, there still has to be something at the source. Now, all these, you know, we measure a lot of parameters to very high accuracy. So, you know, the rotation measure is consistent with you expect to 1%. And in fact, if you go off and say, right, is this scaling with nu squared or lambda squared nu minus 2, is that what you get? The answer for a rotation measure is yes. If you say let me fit the index of the dispersion measure, right? So that's supposed to be again nu to the minus 2. If you fit that, we get nu to the minus 1.998 plus or minus 0.003, right? So it's a spectacular, very accurate measure. So the scattering is also exactly consistent with what you'd expect. There's a, you know, this thing really, you know, this is not a microwave oven at Parkes. This is a real celestial source. And one thing that I worked on too that was actually really fun, again, amazing how much you can pull out of like 1 millisecond flash. So the low density limit is that the dispersion relation goes like nu to the minus 2. But that's not exactly right. So the real dispersion relation is k squared equals omega squared plus omega plasma squared. So as you get closer to the plasma frequency, which is set by the electron density, then you expect to see deviations from this. And the column density was high enough, and our measurement of the effective spectral index is so accurate that we can put an upper limit on any of 10 to the 7 per cubic centimeter. So if you take the total column density and say, here's the upper limit, then that puts a minimum size of the dispersing region of about 10 AUs, right? So this, you know, this guy at least was not coming from a flare star, because you need to have, you need to spread that plasma over a much bigger, you know, out to Neptune or wherever, whatever is 10 AU. Not Neptune, Uranus. So remember back when we said that the scattering, that the whatever does the scattering has to be unresolved angularly by the Milky Way by the time it gets here? So if you work that out, if I put a minimum size of 10 AUs for whatever is doing dispersing and say it has to still be coherent against the Milky Way, that puts it outside the galaxy. So, you know, I think from this, we were able to, just from that flash, convincingly say this is extragalactic. So that's kind of fun. So these things, I think, the inferred distances, if you just say that that dispersion measure is due to standard line of sight electrons, puts them at redshift of a few tenths. So implications, right? Not the microwave oven, looks astronomical, looks extragalactic. This is a thing, you know, if you wanted to do other things with it, this is a little bit of a concern. There's stuff, not surprisingly, if these things are coming from other galaxies, there's stuff near the FRBs. And so if we want to use them as tools for things, we're going to have to worry about this. This was really exciting. So this was the first, this was the first FRB we'd seen in the Chaim Hyrax band. So before that, the Dalton C 1.4 gigahertz. The scattering goes like new to the minus 4. So you don't have to go very far if scattering's a problem before you're dead and your bursts are all scattered away. So it's really encouraging that we saw something at the frequencies we were going to be building instruments to look at these for. Hadn't been done. And since then, more have now been seen by the Molonglo array, Molonglo cylinder, which is in Australia. So we can now commonly say there's going to be a reasonable amount of these things. In fact, the event rate that these guys were seeing, the Molonglo guys were seeing, is something like twice the simplest extrapolation from the Parkes rate. So that's good news. There'll be stuff to see. But now this brings up the harder bite, which is the challenge in doing stuff with FRBs is we need locations. If you want to know what's going on, you really need to know the redshift. And you can't get the redshift without an optical counterpart. And you can't get an optical counterpart without a good position. So you really want an arcsecond or better positions so you know what galaxy these guys have come from. As I said, only one FRB has been seen to repeat. So is this the same thing as the ones that have been seen to flash once and never again? Who knows, right? You know, we haven't seen that many, and we only have one position. And the only reason we could get a position on this one is because it repeated. So you find it with a single dish telescope, which are really good at finding these things. And then you go off and you park the VLA and stare the VLA at the spot and wait for a flash to come back, and then you can get a position. But that's very expensive, right? You know, you don't have a VLA to park at every FRB you're looking at. But this one was found to come from a redshift about 0.19. And the dispersion measure there came about, you know, a third, if you take the standard models for the line of sight, a third came from the host, a third came from the line of sight, and a third came from within the Milky Way. These things may be complicated. So Hyrax is really uniquely suited to change this in a way. You know, the dishes give us flexibility that is hard for Chaim. So if we build more Hyrax dishes and put them a long ways away, point at the same spot in the sky, we can now get VLBI positions, so really accurate positions for all the FRBs that Hyrax sees. If you work through the numbers and say, I'm going to believe an FRB if it's 15 sigma, which is roughly the number you're going to want. It turns out that at 10 sigma, basically, you expect regular 8 or 9 sigma fluctuations just from Gaussian statistics. The search base is so huge. So 15 sigma is actually not a particularly conservative threshold to say I've seen something. So once you have that, though, you know, your search page drops a lot. So if you get a 5 or 6 sigma detection in VLBI, that's enough to say, yes, I think I've seen something real. And that only takes sort of 6 or 8 element outriggers. So 8 dishes fit naturally on 1 FPGA board. So this is a natural way of doing it. You know, go off and I'll build maybe 4 16 dish stations and now get VLBI positions. So these heart rate dishes we've already built will be one site. And they're building a VLBI network in Africa, basically in preparation for SKA. So a lot of these countries are trying to train radio astronomers interested in training at the VLBI sites, AVN sites. There will be atomic clocks, which you need for this, which saves a lot of money. And because we're not trying to make maps, so normally VLBI is really hard to do because you've got to send gigahertz bandwidth data to make a picture. But we only need to do that for when the burst is on. So what you do is you have the outriggers store the last couple of minutes of raw data, but not send it. Then just wait for a trigger from the core array that says, aha, something just happened. So you've got to make sure that latency is low. Not instant, but a few seconds. And then the outrigger station says, OK, now I know when this happened. And I combine all the data from the telescopes. I can look in the direction where HIRAC saw it and send back just that little tiny bit of data. So you can do this. If you're calibration is another issue, but just the raw data for the burst, you can send back over a cell phone link, which is just totally different regime for VLBI than most people. So as long as you put order terabyte of RAM, which is not that expensive, you can do this. So we've started working on this, these are sites that we have either would like to or have talked with people about putting things. Yeah.
So you don't actually. No, so
you'd have to go off and then do a spectrum, but you'd have the galaxy, and you can take your time for the spectrum, right? Because once you know what the galaxy is, then that's not going to change. So this is a natural thing to do with, say, SALT.
But I guess I'm just saying if you don't have, let's say even if you don't have anything optical, but the Mu-20 mass center is supposed to be a redshift server, so.
So if we saw like a 21 centimeter line, we could tell you the redshift. But
yeah. But
these things appear to be broadband, so it's not like we're going to have a spectral line in the signal to work with.
Mm-hmm.
I could make up stories where there are like absorption lines, but that'll be really hard too because of scintillation, right? Isn't it? Knowing that you've seen an absorption line, not just a scintillation, can be really hard. So you do need to go off and do this optically. But you can't do that until the other positions. So this is already built. This is where the core array will be. We could build something near us. We've been talking extensively with people in Botswana who are interested in hosting an outrigger site. And my sister has a friend who runs a game park in Mozambique. And they are, in principle, willing to host a HIRAX array. They have a science array. They're already hosting a NASA experiment there. So I need to go like on a safari for science. Oh, actually true, I've been a little slack because you've been busy, but need to go up there and see if that's okay. Because you want to make sure that the RFI is okay. If you build something in the wrong spot, you'll be blinded. But if you do that, so using just these station places where we more or less have sites picked out, this gives you this resolution. So the scale here is in arc seconds. So the native resolution is something like 0.15 arc seconds. But of course, if you have this at 5 sigma, which you need to be believable, that means you're going to have a positional accuracy of more like 0.03 arc seconds, 30 milli arc seconds, which is fantastic. So not only will you figure out what galaxy, but you'll figure out to 2% where within the galaxy these FRBs are happening. So it lets you do things like if you want to say, I think most of the DM is coming from the galaxy, then maybe if we want to do cosmology with these, we can pick out the FRBs that are on the outskirts and less likely to be contaminated by stuff in the host. We don't know what these things are going to look like yet. We have to go out and do this. But when you start having dozens of positions per day instead of one total, the things you can think about doing really change. So think about that. As I said, I was just, in fact, my shoes are still dirty from this. Right before I came here, Saturday morning, I was driving out of Botswana. We went to the Botswana International University of Science and Technology, who are interested in hosting a HIRAX site. So this is actually on campus. They have a very big campus. So this is looking for a radio quiet site in front of a baobab tree. Can't see here, but actually, baobab fruit turns out to be tasty. So this is a guy from Beust, who's actually originally from Mozambique, so he was having baobab for the first time. But it's really pretty good. If you're ever finding yourself in that situation, feel free to like crack open a bit. So we didn't get very far this day because this happened. This is on campus, but their campus is 25 square kilometers, and So you can see, not all of it is really built up. So we had to hike back. But we went back the next day and did find an actual site on campus that looks like it's going to be OK. So this is very local. But we found a nice, a valley that was just deep enough to block out the interference from nearby cell phone and TV stations. And there's not much else going on, so the rest of the band is pretty clear. So this is encouraging. So we just need to make sure that that they are happy to support the site. They actually have they were given two small, like 2-meter dishes by SKA. So they hired a technician to run those two dishes, which I think would be a very boring job. So they have somebody who should have time to help support this. So we just got to make sure that they can get even cell phone line, we could work something out. But make sure that they get a power line to run. It doesn't take a lot of power. A few hundred watts to a kilowatt is enough to run one of these stations. So get ready for the age of FRBs as probes rather than figuring out what they are. You've got very accurate column density measurements and very accurate timings. So people have shown that actually even current results, you get very competitive results on equivalence tests because if I've got some sort of thing that affects photon propagation speed as a function of mass, you've now got a factor of two different frequency range where you've got millisecond accuracy measurement over cosmological distances. I don't know exactly how useful this would be, but there are some, just as with galaxies, some percent of FRBs are going to be multiply lensed. If you're now in the survey where your regime where you have 0.03 arc second positions, maybe you can actually see this and get the different lens positions. One of the, KSE is a big upcoming thing from CMB missions, and that tells you the integral of velocity times column density. Wouldn't it be great if we had a measurement of the column density? Well, we can do that. A little more speculatively, what if, the event rate is too high that most FRBs are gravitational wave events, but what if gravitational wave events do put out bursts? We could see that. Which would also be a great way of getting positions for gravitational wave events. Now, they also could put out slow transients if you have got, like with GRBs that have long frequency emissions. So we also will see slow transients. The sensitivity number there is a little bit complicated because it depends at some level confusion limited, but confusion limited not by confusion, but by the confusion due to the varying of sources. So it'll be a lot lower and the standard confusion limit, but I don't know what it's actually going to be when you go off and do this in practice. And I've asked people, and they also don't know what it is. So it's not just me. But we'll find this out. Chime will actually find this out any day now, right? Think about this. It's a new tool that'll have some. The things that we see will be incredibly precisely measured, and I think we've only started to scratch the surface of what you might be able to do with them. So our current status. We have applications out, but we have enough money already to build more than 128 dishes, which is already a fairly powerful instrument. We've got 8 elements up and running. A few of them still need to get the feeds, but the electronics are all working. We just need to plug it in. The core site we have selected. We can start sort of second half 2019. That's set by, they're in the process of buying the farm that'll go on, and then there's sort of 2 years of statutory minima waiting to get things rezoned. So this is just set by red tape. Nothing we can do to speed it up. But we're going to try and see if we can put a small array out in the Karoo before then on the SK core site. They won't give us 300 kilowatts, but they might give us a kilowatt. And in the interim, we're going to expand the heart rate array to 32 dishes. And this is now big enough that you could get maybe something like 1 FRB per month. So it's comparable to the Parkes rate, which is non-trivial. And if we build 2 or 3 outrigger stations, put one in Botswana, we build 8 dishes in the Karoo, this is now good enough that maybe we could get 1 FRB position per month starting on a fairly short time scale, which would also be really exciting. A lot of these places, Hart Rau and SK already have atomic clocks, which right away takes away one of the big challenges for doing this. So we will. This won't happen before next year, but it's not a long time process. So in summary, we are excited about this new array we're building, and this will be a great instrument for finding fast radio bursts and pulsars. And It's really, you know, it's really unique to HireAx because you want to see all of your bursts. You need to match the primary beam in the sky, and that means you need to match the metal on the ground. And it's a lot easier to build a $1,000 Chinese dish than it is to build a 20-meter cylinder. So it's much, much, much easier to do this for HireAx. I mean, Chime can do this, but they have to spend a lot more money than we do. And yeah, think of what you can do with thousands of FRBs with way sub-arc-second positions, because that's what we expect to have. And I guess there's not time to talk about the other little thing, right? So if you want to hear about stuff, it's not your fault.
I really can't help
this. But if you want to see pictures of penguins, come talk to me later on. I think we're having it's a different experiment. But yes, we also met penguins for science. So thanks very much for having me here.
What's the maximum beam you are planning to serve?
That's a slightly complicated question. So you can go up to quasi-infinite DM. I mean, there's going to be a limit set by you only see things in the beam for 20 minutes, 15 minutes. And so that puts a very high upper DM limit. The diagonal DM at 65,000 channels is a few thousand. So what happens is you can keep going to higher DM by downsampling the data. So you lose sensitivity to short bursts, but it's not expensive to do. So basically, you combine time samples and rerun the search is the easiest way to do it. I think there's probably more efficient ways to do it, but you can do it that way. And so, in that sense, the running to infinite DM is only, that's a fixed factor of two over just doing the simplest search. So, we'll go to much higher DM. Again, things like the beam crossing time at some point do enter into it. And I think that is 10 or 15,000, something like that. So we can't really go past that, but I think going to high DM is really important. So that's where the thinking of things as optical depth. So all of us who have done SE cosmology know that the optical depth to Thompson scattering through a bright cluster is 0.01. Which means that any FRB coming from a big galaxy cluster will have a DM of at least 5,000 just from the cluster. So we want to go much higher than that.
So this thing that you can actually measure more than the spectral measure is very interesting. And I wonder whether you kind of exploited it more. Like, I mean, in principle, I'm just thinking you could get, in principle, higher moments of the density. The first one would be integral of density, which is deep, but you can get integral of density as squared and other things if you could get the whole. Do you see what I'm saying?
If you're saying what I think you're saying, the answer is probably no, right? So what we can see, so clumping doesn't matter except through the variation in plasma frequency.
Yeah.
Right. So if that clumping happens, but it still is at a low enough density that you don't change the plasma frequency enough to be detectable, then you don't get that measurement. Now we will get these constraints. It'll with bright bursts and a larger frequency lever, it'll be a factor of 10 better than that. But we're not going to get to light year scale.
So I guess it's one of our newer square. Dispersion. Is there any detectable deviation from that in your data or not?
In the very small sample size so far, not yet. But again, right, so to get a detectable deviation from that, you need to start talking about putting a significant fraction of the dispersion on 10 AU scales. Mm-hmm. Maybe 100 AU scales probably is, we'll do better, so we can make that limit larger. But that's what we're talking about.
Yeah. Chime will feed, is, do I understand correctly, will detect a comparable number of FRBs per day, but won't get galaxy positions for you. Is that right?
I would say yes. Kendrick may be better suited. So, I mean, they're talking about doing things like parking ARO in the Chime field, but right? So because those primary beams don't line up, right, you'll only get the bursts that happen to fall inside the ARO field of view. And that is going to drop you off by 2 orders of magnitude, 3 orders of magnitude, something like that. I don't know what the solid beam overlap is, but that's why the dish thing works much better.
We're scheming to co-observe with some other telescopes that maybe get a VLBI after me. There's no scenario where we would get like many per day.
Yeah, unless you guys go off and build more cylinders. So if you build three cylinders, you can do it. But that's a lot more expensive than throwing a few more satellite dishes on the ground.
Can you buy some dishes and put a radio cylinder?
So you would...
Yeah, it's like besides FRBs, do you have any plans for like analyzing, having more agnostic models for looking for transients?
So we'll certainly look for slow transients, right? So you get a map of the sky in that patch every day, so you can basically do a diff on that, and you can see if things are varying on day and longer timescales.
How much does having a good model for your transient depend on like actually being able to see lots of these?
I'm not sure I understood enough to answer your question.
I guess it's just... I assume you have like you're gonna have like a huge amount of data coming in from these things, and it's a big data science type project, and so besides FRBs, do you have sort of other models for transients that you're shooting for that are sort of
So it really depends on the time scale you're talking about, right? So searching for FRBs is totally different from searching for slow transients, because the FRBs, you've got the dispersion measure, whereas if something is varying on time scale slower than the dispersion time scale, then you just see a source that gets brighter and fainter that's achromatic. And so we will, we'll make maps of the sky every day. So again, things that are varying on, long in the beam crossing time, we will see. Things that are varying on, minute time scales, which could happen. I mean, nobody's expecting FRBs, so easy to be out there. That's harder to search for, but not necessarily impossible. So we haven't worked out how the pipeline would look for that. So basically what you would do there is make maps every minute and then look for changes in that. We might be able to save minute timescale maps. It starts to become a little bit of annoyance data-wise, but it's you could conceive of doing it. And for that, right, you'd expect that you wouldn't necessarily care about that on a multi-day timescale. So maybe you make minute-long maps, which we could do, and then throw away once we've seen it those transients.
The -2 index is kind of hardwired into the search algorithm. Sorry, if there were a with frequency. Delay portion of the frequency of -2.1. We'd probably never know it was there.
Yeah, well, Vicky's been very excited about this. You can do the search for any index you want.
Right.
So you could do a...
you were planning for some searches, right? But I guess just very small deviations about the -2.
Yeah, okay, so for that what I went back to the raw data and said, let me just fit this, which is different than the search. We would have been sensitive. I think if you say right, what given the parameters of the data, you'd be sensitive over. I think it was plus or minus 0.4, 0.3, something like that. Not quite that big, maybe 0.04. It was a factor of like 10 or 20 bigger than the error bar we got. So it didn't have to be at -2. If you care about something different from -2. You can certainly do the search there. I thought about what you do, really broad spectrum. There's probably like a tree of trees you could do to do this efficiently. But if you come up with a model to really, we have enough to do that it may get lost without real motivation. But if you have a model that motivates somebody, you should not be shy about chiming in. Any other questions?
All right, let's try it again.
Thanks, everybody.